What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Real Asian Podcast. I'm your host, Raymond Liu. I'm here with the crew, Alan Duong and Brian Tang.
What's up, guys? This is Alan.
Yo, this is Brian.
All right, so the movie we just watched recently is Always Be My Maybe. It's a rom-com written by Ali Wong and Randall Park, directed by Ninotchka Khan. The movie tells the story of Sasha Tran and Marcus Kim, who've known each other their whole lives. Growing up as neighbors, they were inseparable. During their senior year in high school, Randall's mom, Judy, passes away in an accident, and Sasha invites Marcus out as a way to cheer him up. And as they're hanging out in Marcus's car,
they bone.
Yes, they get it on. One thing leads to another. So apparently they lose their virginity to each other.
I don't know if I ever did it in the back of a car, though, but you know.
I actually lost my virginity in a car. But anyways, as they're getting food, Marcus tells Sasha that he plans to not go away to college because he wants to stay home in San Francisco to take care of his dad. Years later, Sasha is in L.A. and has grown to become a famous celebrity chef who's about to come back to San Francisco to open up a restaurant. Back in San Francisco, she reconnects with Marcus. However, in adulthood, they've clearly grown to be two different people. Sasha is ambitious and career-driven, while Marcus hasn't changed much while staying in SF. Eventually, they do rekindle the romance, but now they kind of face the challenge of adapting to each other's lifestyle. However, in the end, as any good rom-com will have it, Marcus realizes he would rather be with Sasha as his lover in life over everything. We're just going to kind of go around the table here. I kind of wanted to ask you guys just right off the bat what you guys thought of the movie when you watched it.
I really liked it. It caught me by surprise. But I've watched Ali's stand-up comedy. So that's kind of like my own perception of her. But coming into this, because she wrote the story and everything, it actually caught me by surprise. And it was actually really, really funny. And I would say the cherry on top was definitely the ending. I absolutely loved, loved, loved the ending. On top of the fact that, man, dude, just growing up in the Bay Area, San Francisco, there were so many tributes, callbacks, and people who grew up here would totally understand the scenery and the settings and all the little intricate details of this movie, dude. That was bomb.
First off, I give it a 4 out of 5 stars, perhaps even 4.5 if I'm given that opportunity. I thought the film was uniquely positioned for Bay Area Asian Americans, primarily because it's set in that area. It's a typical rom-com, but I think what made me like it a lot more was that it centered around an Asian American story, one in which was actually quite relatable.
I really enjoyed it, kind of in the same vein what you guys mentioned. It's kind of like an ode or a love letter to San Francisco or just Bay Area in general. And, you know, growing up around here in this area, I connected and got a lot of the references they made and wrote into the movie. And it was just kind of like a good old classic feel-good movie with Asian characters, Asian faces. And it was just nice to kind of see something like that. So I kind of wanted to talk about the two characters, the two leads in the movie, Marcus, played by Randall Park, and Sasha, played by Ali Wong. Marcus, we're kind of shown and seen as like that dude that just never grew out of his own way.
I mean, we all know that.
We all know that guy, right? I mean, quite honestly, I have those moments in my life where you just don't want to do anything. And it does scare you a little bit. And I think that was the point of what they were trying to convey, is like change is tough. For Marcus, you know, I think obviously the pivotal moment in his life was when his mom passed away.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Absolutely, there was definitely a fork in his life there. Think about how he and Sasha were progressing in their lives. You know, you have this huge tragic moment, which I know many Bay Area Asian Americans, not just Asian people, feel, and it causes a lot of folks to just kind of stop their lives. And it was real, and I like that.
One of the things I thought about is that almost kind of like part of Bay Area culture?
Yeah, I will say that I know, unfortunately, a lot of people like that who lost parents because they immigrated from Vietnam, and like a parent couldn't make it, and they just kind of hung around. Not that that's bad, but it was, when I saw Marcus, I thought a lot of my friends from high school.
I'm one of those people too. I thought I would like to live somewhere else, right? But that never happened. And it's hard to leave the Bay Area because it's just everything here.
Let me tie it back to Marcus, but there's always a place and time for everything. And he might have pushed his, growth process or moving outwards you know, further into his life, only after he realized that, you know, he's been staying with his dad and using excuses to stay with his family. But I mean, at the end of the day, he ultimately moved. And I think it's more of a matter of when do you feel that the time is right? So tying it back to me, yeah, I looked at LA for a little while. I don't think the time is right. I looked at San Francisco when I was younger, you know, and at that time I thought it was right. But like, you know, you go through experiences where that is not like the best decision for you at that time. So there's always going to become a point in time where you can decide to move somewhere else.
What about you, Alan? You actually grew up in San Jose and you recently just moved to San Francisco. Is it two different worlds?
I would say yes, two different mentalities rather, because San Francisco is obviously still in the Bay Area, as is San Jose. I would say like the people you meet are significantly different. For example, San Francisco is much more of a transient town mm-hmm. where you have people who aren't from the Bay Area. And then from San Jose to Sunnyvale, where I lived for 2 years, it's mostly folks who have kind of always been in the Bay Area. Different mentalities, despite the fact that they're less than an hour away.
You know, something I noticed with the type of comedy that Ali Wong tends to do, and a lot of comedians do, is a lot of it is social commentary, right? But they make kind of jokes about it. Some of the things that they point out with just like, you know, Asian cultures and Asian nuances that only us we would get.
Yeah. So can I really quickly, I went to watch one of her most recent stand-up comedies in San Francisco, and she had a tidbit where she talked about fucking, am I allowed to say fucking?
Yeah, you said fucking. We talked about
that. Where she talks about fucking like a Vietnamese guy named Vu Tran, and she was like, oh, actually, no, that's not a good idea because his girlfriend, Sasha Nguyen, Tweet Nguyen or some shit like that. And I was like, fuck, man, that's so true.
It's clear that Marcus is Korean in the movie, but it's not clear what Sasha's ethnicity is in the movie. Do you think that was intentional?
I actually go against that notion, actually. I mean, granted, growing up in the Bay Area, we just had a conversation about this earlier, but her last name is Tran, for God's sakes. You know? And I think her dad's name is Kwok, and I forget what the mob's name was. There's another minor detail, I think, in the movie that really shows that she is Vietnamese and Chinese, and I think it was the dishes that she was cooking.
Mm.
Same with Randall Park and his mom. Randall Park and his mom made that, I don't know. I mean, what was that? That red dish?
Kimchi jjigae or something like that. All our Korean listeners would be like, you just butchered it. It's basically like it's not a Korean. Japchae. Yeah. It was a Korean soup.
But
stew.
There was also scenes where she herself was in her San Francisco home and she was cooking whatever she was cooking. I think that's an authentic Vietnamese dish.
Are you talking about when she was a kid when it was spam and rice?
No. Spam and rice.
I was like, by the way, that spam a little undercooked for my taste.
she cooked it?
Yeah. I was like, I like mine more on the darker.
She was like 6 years old, man.
Mine crispy. How do you like your spam?
Crispy.
Always a little on the toastier side.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know if it was ambiguous in terms of her ethnicity, but the larger question that you had was whether that would have made a difference. I don't, honestly really don't think so. I think the reason why is because in the Bay Area, even us Asians, we just kind of say we're Asian. Mm-hmm. It's funny though, because in Ali Wong's stand-up, she specifically calls out Koreans, and you know, she's like, what's the benefit of dating another Asian that you and this other Asian can shit on Koreans together?
So if I had to pick between the two characters, I feel like I connected with Marcus a lot more. And we'll talk about Sasha in a bit, but with Marcus, he had all this talent, like being in a band and stuff like that. And he just kind of what his dad said at one point in the movie, where he let the world pass through him. But I think the point of it was like there's so much change that he just wasn't ready for. And it was shown when he didn't want to audition at Southeast and, you know, take his talents to another bigger venue. Yeah, there's moments in your life where sometimes you do have a lot of doubt and you're just like, man, I don't want to take that leap. Well, I feel like, Alan, you probably more the Sasha type. More of the ambition, career-driven type.
Yeah, and I kind of feel a little guilty thinking that way. So a quick history about my life in terms of why I think I identify with Sasha, and Raymond's completely right. I was in a relationship with someone for quite so long. You remember Sarah? I dated Sarah when out of college, and we dated for almost 3 years.
Was she the crazy one?
No, unfortunately not. But I broke up because I specifically told her that I didn't feel that our relationship was going anywhere. And I made that decision from that point on to study for my GMAT because I wanted to make something more out of my life. Not that I hadn't been, but I was in the military. And I, like Sasha, just kind of leap of faith. Went full stop, balls to the wall for my GMAT studies, and I wouldn't be where I am today had I not made that critical decision of telling myself, I want more than what Eastside San Jose has typically produced.
You need to spread your wings.
Yeah, I really need to spread my wings, and it's paid dividends for my life.
I respect a lot of what Sasha is doing, and I completely understand, and I see why she does it. I also see why Marcus chooses the way, or why Marcus made the decisions he did. Yeah, you can always say it's comfortability, but at the same time, maybe he knew what he wanted to be. He was comfortable with who he was, and he just kind of rode that path. I mean, that didn't stop him from pursuing what he wanted to do, and that was music, and he pursued it.
Mm-hmm.
What was strange is that he wasn't ambitious enough to even go to the other side of town and perform in that area in Southeast, right? That is something that I can't really, that's something that maybe I don't resonate with. But aside from that, everything that he's done and decisions that he's made, I think there's a time and place for everything. And then he pursued what he wanted to pursue at that time, which I can totally, totally understand.
I also feel like with Marcus's perspective, why I connected more with it is that there's the aspect of home, right? He kind of represents, like he says at some point, San Francisco is my home. I know everything here. And if we're looking at it from Sasha's perspective, right, she's from San Francisco, but she moved to LA to pursue this career and kind of got invested in this superficial life, this high fashion celebrity life, this fast paced life. But I think what the movie is trying to convey in that moment between the relationship where they kind of like get back together and they're happy is that Sasha goes like, thanks for kind of reminding me what home feels like. When it comes to having a family party or gathering, stuff like that, we really look forward to those events because it's an opportunity for all of us to kind of come back together and like have fun and like see people we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, and I think what the film is also conveying too was, hey, Marcus reminded Sasha of home, but to Sasha, home is kind of where the heart is. And I hate saying that so much, but it's so true because home to her is being with someone who reminded her of home, which was Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, her home isn't in San Francisco. It's always going to be San Francisco, right? That's hometown. But her home is Marcus. And she's okay with moving to New York because she knows she has that one piece of home, which is Marcus. And that's true for a lot of Asians who identify as people like Sasha, where home is always going to be San Jose. Andrew Hill High School.
You're just throwing out the East Side San Jose sign.
All you folks who grew up in the Bay Area, East Side San Jose, you know what's up. We drink boba and hang out with Mexicans.
Did that, you know, when you draw those six lines and then you connect to create
the S.
Is that an East Side San Jose thing?
No, I actually did a full deep dive Wikipedia analysis on this, and no one knows where it came from, to be quite honest.
If anyone listening kind of knows what we're talking about, you basically draw six vertical lines, three vertical lines, and then three underneath that. But then you connect them, and it kind of draws like an S.
I have no idea where the hell I got that, but it was so prevalent in East Side San Jose. But yeah, but Sasha's home is Marcus.
Let's talk about Sasha. So she kind of represents that fast-paced, superficial life. But she also, part of her character is that she also falls for like the wrong guys, right? Her initial love interest is Brandon, who's a restaurant developer, who's kind of just with her. They're just together just for the pictures and for publicity. But you see in the scene where they're in the limo together and they're not even talking to each other. And then also the other love interest in Sasha's life is Keanu Reeves.
Keanu!
It's a fictitious version of himself, but he plays Keanu Reeves and he's like seen as like this most pompous asshole. Hilarious, though. I love his cameo in the movie.
Fucking great.
She's actually a very, very interesting character. There was a scene in the movie where I think Marcus called her out and said that everything about your childhood you painted with a shit brush?
Shit brush, yep.
And the people that she dated too was completely opposite of Marcus. I don't know if it was intended, but it just seems to me that throughout her entire life, as she was pursuing her culinary dreams and goals, she was chasing everything that kind of went against her childhood. Left San Francisco, went down to LA, eventually New York, chased guys that are opposite of Marcus. At the end of the movie, she got with Marcus and opened a restaurant in New York that's paid homage and tribute to her home in San Francisco.
A lot of rom-coms, they do this. They show all the wrong things to wrap it up in a pretty bow to the person that they're supposed to be with. And that was Marcus. And I think it was important to do that because they wanted to show that Marcus in the end was the protagonist. And at the end, the theme of the movie really is, where's home for you? And home for her was, again, as I beat down like a dead horse, is Marcus.
So let's talk about rom-coms in general. I'm going to be honest. I personally love a good rom-com every now and then. I think I bring this up because sometimes there's a rom-com that goes out there, that comes out, and people kind of watch it and it's supposed to feel good. And then there's sometimes some people who kind of give it like a harsh review. It's kind of like action films. You know, when sometimes think too deeply into action films, it's like it's an action film. Like they're supposed to be explosions and gunfight and, you know, exaggerated everything. And exactly. Rom-coms is the same thing. So you kind of take it as it is. Let's talk about the genre in general, because from our perspective, and specifically in mine, rom-coms were always very much, you know, white protagonist. The male lead was this handsome white guy, blue-eyed, more oftentimes than not. And same thing with like the female lead. If we're painting an Asian-American brush over a rom-com, do we appreciate it more, or do we still take it as is? Like, it's still very like a rom-com. It just happens to be with Asian people.
I personally think it's just like a rom-com, just with Asian people. But I think that's important, though, because it normalizes Asian Americans as part of the story. Because as you mentioned, Raymond, for so long, all rom-coms were just white people. And I personally thought it was helpful to show that, hey, yo, like Asian people can have rom-coms too, which are a little cringy at times. But the reason why I like this movie so much is because, you know, I look at them and I'm like, yeah, I mean, they have a lot of good callbacks to Bay Area and then some Asian stories, but it's still a rom-com.
I agree. I want to just look at it as another rom-com. I think it's wonderful that Asians now get to portray themselves as more than just comedic relief, although this is a romantic comedy. But it's really interesting, right? Just because of there are male leads in a romantic film who are Asian. And there are multiple Asian males in this film that portray the Hulk-like amazing aura, where you have Daniel Dae-Kim and then you have Marcus as like the male protagonist. And those are characters that traditionally Asians have not been able to fill in Hollywood. So it's nice that we were able to break that mold. At the end of the day, I do want to view this as a romantic comedy because, like, and it does a really good job at it, right? I'm not saying that it's not a good, like, not a bad film by any means. I appreciate the fact that they're Asian. I do want to look at it as just another romantic comedy.
Any top of mind favorite rom-coms though, growing up?
Dude, Princess Bride. That is the best rom-com. Marriage is what brings us together today.
Ryan?
The only one I can think about on top of my head is No Strings Attached. Ashton Kutcher and Natalie Portman.
Oh yeah, I was going to say. So there's two classic ones that I like that are 1A, 1B. I like Just Friends, which is the one with Ryan Reynolds and Amy Smart, I think.
Classic.
That one's on Netflix, I think. And that one's kind of like a Christmassy romantic comedy as well. And then 10 Things I Hate About You.
I knew it. Oh, I freaking knew it. That's a good freaking movie. That's a good one.
I mean, it's an adaption of Taming of the Shrew, I think.
Right, yeah. That's exactly right. I know Cindy keeps mentioning that to me. She loves that movie.
10 Things I Hate About You, Julia Stiles and Heath Ledger.
Heath Ledger, man. That was his like launch pad movie. Well, The Dark Knight was his best, but definitely this one was good.
That was a pretty solid movie. Rom-coms as a perfect first date, agree or disagree?
I would have to say it's up there. I wouldn't say it's perfect first date, but I mean, it's not a bad first date by any means. It breaks the ice, it's light, it's easy-hearted, it leaves you with a lot of things to talk about, especially from what you see inside the movie for like your own dates and ideas and stuff.
Wait, are you saying like a rom-com first date in the movies or like in this current environment of
COVID? Like if you were to take someone out on a first date, a rom-com, do you think that's a good, a fair assessment where that's like a perfect first date movie?
I mean, it really depends on the person because maybe she's just loves horror movies, perhaps. But I would say generally, yes, primarily because if you don't like the person, you don't have to talk to each other, and you can kind of enjoy the movie together, and then you can have something to talk about, and then kind of like dig out like, oh, what'd you think about this person? And she's like, oh, I hated her because she's XYZ. And then you think to yourself, but I like that person.
This ain't a good person.
This ain't it. This is when I was dating the girl who called REI Ray, and I knew this would not work out. You don't hike.
Wait, can you tell that story real quick?
I was dating a girl. Oh, God. I was dating a girl, and we met on Tinder. And on her profile, she specifically said that she loves to hike. And I thought to myself, hey, shit, I love to hike too. Let's go. So we met up. And then prior to our hike, I was like, hey, you know what? I got to stop by somewhere to pick some stuff up prior to the hike. And she's like, oh, okay, perfectly fine with me. We pull up to the REI in Mountain View, my favorite REI ever. And we pull up there and she's like, oh, Ray? I love Ray. And in my mind, I'm like, how do you know my cousin Raymond? Why are you calling him Ray? I was like, is he here? I was going to text you, but then I was like, do you mean REI? She's like, oh no, see, down in San Diego we call it Ray. I'm like, no, that no, this ain't working. It was in the back of my mind for the rest of my life, and it still is.
Somewhere out there, there's someone that truly believes REI is called Ray. I want to talk about one of the themes that I kind of picked out when I was watching Always Be My Maybe, and that's kind of like specifically about SF, and that's the idea of dualism. SF is this unique place where it's almost kind of like a clash between old and new, right? SF obviously has a long history, but the tech explosion, the migration of job opportunity, and just the Bay Area as a whole, so many different things have come into San Francisco where it struggles sometimes to try to maintain its old traditions, its like rooted authenticity, but then also shares like the new age, right, is the heart of technology and innovation.
Yeah, we think about culture, we think about food, we think about arts, we think about performing arts, music. That was what made up San Francisco, in the beginning of this film. And then later in the film, like, you can see that it's clearly gentrified.
Mm-hmm. And like, you can see the high rises, the buildings and everything like that.
Yeah, yeah. I will say, though, that most of the location was shot in Toronto. So, but yes, it went way out of its way to show that San Francisco became gentrified. And then on that, Marcus actually talked about how he made a line in the movie towards the end where he's like, Asian food isn't elevated. It's fucking authentic. It's, right. Eat out of a big ass bowl. And all you Asian listeners right now, like, you have to agree with this. I've never been to an Asian household where they serve you a single plate. No. It's a big ass plate of food.
But so my question for that is that, do you ever think Asian food should ever be spotlighted like that? Kind of like, because obviously there's some really high end Asian restaurants out there.
It's actually, I do want a moment of appreciation for how they portrayed the differences in the dishes there. Like, Asian dishes, authenticity typically comes from a large bowl. And they clearly show the difference between gentrification. Now dishes comes in like, flavors of whatever. I think when you think about authenticity, it's not the size of it that matters. Let's say we're in a conversation with our friends and we're asking, the question comes up, where you want to go eat Vietnamese food. You have a couple choices. One choice is clean, nice in a restaurant, pretty expensive. Then the other one, you get a bowl of pho for, $3, huge ass bowl. Which one are you going to go to? And typically, it's weird, right? But like, shit, I'll go to the cheaper one. Not because it's cheaper, but it's like, dude, that's my people. That's like the type of food that we typically serve. And that's how it's always been. I can't even fathom paying, $14 for a bowl of pho. Or nowadays in San Francisco, there's like this one joint and like somewhere in the Mission, it's like fucking $12 for a bunny sandwich. Shit, I get three of those for the price of fucking four,
Let me tell you something about these freaking elevated Vietnamese banh mi. Okay, I'm Vietnamese and I speak it fluently, okay? Cindy and I, we went to a banh mi shop in San Francisco, somewhere in Hayes Valley, and they charged $15 for a banh mi made from a white guy named Hunter. Man. I saw this man just destroy my entire culture by not doing it correctly, and what? The baguette wasn't even freaking crispy. I need that baguette sandwich shell to drip all over my pants. The flavors were good, I will give you that, but it was not an authentic banh mi.
What meat was it?
At least it had meat.
It had, yeah, thank God. It was this like braised pork belly that was too soft. Like it wasn't like it wasn't sasiu, you know, char siu,
yeah.
Which is what I prefer. Or you're gonna get like a somok, which is a number one sandwich when you go to Lee's or when you go to Hung Lan in San Jose. Those are legit Vietnamese sandwiches. Those are some banh mi's, okay.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of lines in the movie where Marcus was talking to his dad. I think he was giving him a shot, and he says like, another hipster donut shop opening in an old laundromat, an artisan roast beef sandwich opening up in a record store. San Francisco is this place where kind of like irony is trendy, you know? Because even when at the fancy restaurant, we can talk about the restaurant scene with Keanu, where Ali Wong says, like, rich people don't wear tuxes anymore. They wear $600 shirts that look like they got out of a thrift store.
Kind of true.
It's true, right? True, it's yeah. So true. Like, if you go around San Francisco, and I'm guilty of it every now and then, too, you see guys with Patagonia jackets and vests. But wearing sandals and, like, t-shirts.
Birkenstocks now.
Birkenstocks. And honestly, it's all about comfort for me. And sometimes if it's just a quick stepping out of my house, I'll be guilty of that.
Yeah, for context, too, like, we're in the middle of coronavirus. And so I'm in shorts, like, 99% of the time, despite being in San Francisco, which is windy and cold.
But let's talk about the restaurant, the dinner scene with Keanu. I love that scene, by the way. And the fact that the dishes are like concepts.
Concepts rather than actual meals themselves. Keanu's so great in that scene. I freaking love Keanu.
But honestly, it's not that far off, I feel like.
I agree. And you know, it serves as a great breaking the fourth wall with Marcus in that seat. Because whoever's watching that movie, you're probably thinking, what the fuck? And that's exactly how Marcus reacts.
Let's go ahead and take a break.
As an imported Asian adoptee or hyphenated Asian, are you looking for stories and people that you can relate to? If yes, then check out The Universal Asian. The Universal Asian is an open platform run in the magazine style with written articles, poetry, prose, photos, art, and videos on a variety of topics. No topic is off limits. They host online events that showcase what members of our Universal Asian community are doing or provide support through how-tos or discussions on topics of interest. Visit and subscribe at theuniversalasian.com or follow them on your preferred social media platform. Join the Universal Asian community today.
So the nonprofit that I'm a part of, we have a New York chapter, and this is when Ali Wong was in New York, and I think this is right when she was starting out her stand-up career.
Oh, no shit.
Now, nice. I wasn't there, but one of the founders, one of the earlier people, leaders in our organization said that we host an annual tasting benefit, which you've joined.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Play by play. Now, I don't know which year it was, but it was early on, and Ali Wong was a performer at that event in New York.
Shit. Wow.
Now, if you know Ali Wong's comedy, it's not...
rambunctious.
It's very raunchy. The founder saw her act and was just like, had her jaw dropped because she wasn't expecting
it. In a good or bad way?
I don't know. Okay, so to be honest, I think at the time she was like, there's no way I can have this person ever return.
Uh-huh.
Because the event is meant to be glitzy and you know, high class.
Crazy Rich Asians before Crazy Rich Asians?
Kind of, right? And the founder said that when she was preparing and getting her to go on stage, she was very shy. So it's just like Ali Wong is actually a pretty shy person. Like we can just talk to her normally. But then she gets on that stage, it's a whole new act. I mean, of course, right? That's what stand-up comedy is.
Yep.
The founder said, I'm never having her back on again. But she tells that story every time. And I'm thinking like, man, we could have had like Ali Wong as like an ally to our organization or a supporter or something like that. And I was like, man, we got to get her back. She's obviously very quite unique, right? Even with her two specials, she's both specials she's done when she was pregnant, which is like never been done before.
Was the second one she was pregnant? Yeah, she was
pregnant for both of them.
Yes, that's right. Yes, she was.
But you know, when I hear that story, I'm like, man, that would have been nice to have Ali Wong be part of our organization or like a little bit connected. Now we've invited her. I think we tried to reach out to her. She's familiar with us. But she's way too big now.
Yeah, damn.
And I think she lives in LA. So if she was to come back, she would do the LA event. But we're not having events this year, so.
That's true.
So I want to talk about Jenny. Ali Wong said that she said she wrote that character. She'd been wanting to write a character like that for the longest time. I think one of it was in Fresh Off the Boat. And what's funny is that Jenny, she says that she's known a lot of Jennies, and that's kind of where the character comes from.
These Jennies exist in Berkeley. I know because I go to school there. They exist.
Kind of talk about that type of person or that character.
This type of person, this type of Jenny is an Asian woman, man too, who is just this ultra hippie. I don't even know the right adjective for this, to be quite honest, but it's exactly what Jenny is portrayed as. You have this person who's just constantly thinking about, oh, like we're all part of this earth and everything must be perfect. And they live in the hills of Berkeley and they go to UC Berkeley.
Marcus and I are married, but not in your normal hetero transformative type.
They all go to what the hell is that show or the concert in Vegas or in the deserts?
Burning Man.
They all go to Burning Man and they have, they are all different, but unique in their own way.
And she's always like, yes.
Yes, bitch.
It was actually pretty funny, but on the subject of Jenny. There was another scene in the movie when Sasha was peeping on Facebook what Brandon was up to in India, as in India, the country. And on her iMessages, there was Denise. It was like a conversation between the two, Sasha and Denise. But the message stated, hey, is there anywhere I can find vegan, gluten-free, I think it was tacos around the area? Oh my God, dude, speaking of gentrification in San Francisco, that is the thing. Gluten-free, vegan, hot shit.
You know what's funny too, on that note, you know how fast people went away from being gluten-free the moment COVID-19 hit because all the freaking non-gluten shit went off the shelves.
Oh, really?
Immediately. I'm like, oh, I thought San Francisco was a very gluten-free city. Clearly that's not the case.
No, not when life and death is on the line.
The thing that was suspiciously absent from the movie was kombucha and LaCroix. Where the hell was that?
Was LaCroix big when this movie came out? It was, right? I'm not a LaCroix drinker, by the way. I don't drink it at all, so you listeners have to kind of educate me.
Dude, I am all about LaCroix. I'm guilty of it. It's like the one thing and I'm like freaking ashamed when I drink it. When I pop that can, I'm like, ugh, whatever. And then I fucking enjoy the shit out of it. What's your favorite Keanu Reeves movie?
It's either John Wick or it's the first Matrix.
The Matrix has to be the more iconic one, right? I thought John Wick was entertaining as shit, though.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just off the fucking walls.
I own a gun. Mm-hmm. I love John Wick. But The Matrix was just phenomenal.
Yeah, The Matrix was an iconic movie at the time. Why was it so... Was it because of the special effects, do you think?
You mean that particular bullet scene?
Yeah.
I don't know, dude. It has to be, dude. Man, when I was in elementary school or middle school, I was doing that shit with nothing.
You're like, trying to figure out, like, how did he bend over backwards?
Just bending like backwards, dude, in slow motion, just trying to imitate that.
You're like,
for no reason,
stretching every time.
I think what made Matrix really popular was at the time, that type of movie hadn't existed yet. They showed this to like a version of it, and they showed a specific scene where Trinity, you know, she got up, she jumped up, and then the camera zooms around and she kicks the policeman. They showed that to like the people who wanted to greenlight the film, and they automatically fell in love with the special effects. And then from that, it bred this whole new gun-fu type of cinema into
special
Hollywood.
Effects.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's tough for me. I think The Matrix is pretty up there, but I've seen all three John Wicks, and man, I think what won it for me for John Wick was watching the behind the scenes and the production leading up to it. So I watched a bunch of videos of them
dedication.
Training for it.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And like, I forget the director's name, but he like, that's like part of the deal that when they sign up for the movie, and he was particularly talking to Halle Berry, who's in the third one. He's like, if you are in this, it's like 6 to 8 months of no life, just straight training. And she was like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm down for it.
Yeah, the director is Chad, I'm totally going to butcher his name, Stilinski. One thing he really wanted to convey in the movie was a single shot of action being portrayed. So that at the time wasn't really prevalent in Hollywood, but was very prevalent in Chinese martial arts, gun fu. And he, Chad, he loved that type of style. And so he made sure that Keanu was exactly. And so he, and at the time, think about the movies that the action films that were shown around this 007, Taken, like it's all quick cut action. And even think about the first Batman Begins movie with Christopher Nolan. It's just quick cut action. You punch the air and then someone, you hear a sound effect.
Right.
But John Wick was real and Keanu balls to the wall.
So you mentioned Gung Fu, right? That style of fight choreography that it kind of originated, right? It did. I didn't realize it at the time, but when you think back at it and you watch old movies, it's always kind of been like that style in Chinese culture, old school Kung Fu movie, that like over the top kind of stuff. I mean, is that a form of appropriation?
That is a really good question. But let's first tackle what exactly are we qualifying as cultural appropriation, though?
Let's say the creators of the movie didn't give credit to where they had that original influence. And they're just like, oh, this is groundbreaking for us. We're coming up with this new concept. I would say that'd be appropriation because it's kind of taking something that you most likely saw and you're like, oh, we can westernize that and bring it over to the States. If they somehow, you know, when they were creating it, they were like, oh, you know, we were really influenced from Chinese Kung Fu movies and that's where we got it. Mm-hmm. Then it's like, okay. But at the same time, I just don't know if it got enough or the deserved credit that it should have.
Yeah, so cultural appropriation, I think it's a neutral term. It's neither good nor bad, right? Think about the Silk Road way back in the day where, you know, cultures were always exchanged and that wasn't a bad thing. I think when cultural appropriation becomes a negative connotation is when it's done so in a mocking manner or without respecting the history of appropriating one's culture. So I think what John Wick and Chad, the director for John Wick, what he really did was not only borrow elements of Gung Fu in classic Hong Kong films, was to flesh it out for an American audience. And he did it the right way. I thought he did it the right way. One aspect of cultural appropriation that I believe is Infernal Affairs, where Martin Scorsese, he completely ripped off the movie and then put it as The Departed. Tom Brady, Pack the Con, Harvard Yard. But Martin Scorsese,
terrible Boston accent.
But Martin Scorsese himself, like he admitted that he was influenced very heavily by it. But a lot of American people didn't realize that Infernal Affairs was the OG.
I didn't know that. To be honest.
Yeah,
and I love The Departed.
The Departed is really good.
It's a classic.
It's a classic movie. But Infernal Affairs is.
Well, so where did Infernal Affairs originate from?
Hong Kong.
Mm.
Yeah, it's classic. Andy Lau's in that freaking movie.
Oh, wow, Andy Lau.
You know, no, the beautiful man who sings, singer. But he also acts.
Interesting thing that also another thing I researched is that Ali Wong and Randall Park, so they knew of each other from Randall Park's theater company that he founded in UCLA.
This is real life, by the way,
this
folks.
This is real life, yeah. They do tell where they officially met at a party that Randall threw with his friends, which is a fried rice cooking contest. Brian, if you had to cook a signature fried rice dish, what would it be?
Okay, I have to preface it by saying that I'm a horrible cook. Assuming that I can cook. Shit, dude, I don't even fucking know. Steak? Because I can't cook, dude. I don't know what tastes good.
Damn, that's hella elevated.
Yeah.
Some elevated fried rice.
Medium rare only. Lap jiao. That is like sausage.
Chinese sausage.
Yeah, Chinese sausage. It's great. Egg, lots of pepper. Fucking, what else can I stick in there?
You stick in there, huh?
Now I'm getting a visual. Not a good visual. What can you put in fried rice that makes it taste amazing?
That is the beauty of fried rice, is that it's a potpourri of deliciousness.
Mm-hmm. Egg, French fries.
French fries.
You know what? Some people like ketchup. Some people stick tomato sauce in that stuff, right?
So you'd...
You know what? Red rice. Tomato red rice. Tomato rice. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, dude. That's it. That shit tastes so good.
Okay.
Bell peppers. Oh, man, dude. I'm a chef in the making right now.
This,
peppers,
this
green,
sounds some
red.
Fancy ass fried
it
rice.
It is elevated, and it is not something I would pay for because I don't support that shit, but I would cook it if I can.
Okay.
I don't know, man. What do you...
Alan, what would be your... fried rice dish?
My fried rice dish would be my mom's fried rice dish with a little bit of my dad's. My dad's, he has a tendency to put a lot of, he puts some fish oil in there, nook mom. And for me, my mom, she uses a week old rice. That's the most important thing. You can't use too fresh rice. Lap chung, obviously. And then she'll put in a bit of spam in there as well. And the most important thing in a fried rice, in my opinion, is not just the eggs that go in there, but also the vegetables. So you have the frozen peas, frozen carrots, frozen corn, frozen green beans in there. You have butter in there as well. And then you put in the large grinded black pepper, some salt, and you put the most important thing in there to really put it together. Soy sauce, dark soy sauce.
I thought you were going to say love.
And love. And a mother's love. And you know it's good because your mom is there cooking it, and then she fucking takes a whole goddamn big spoonful and she eats it, and you're like, the fuck, that's for me. She's like, oh, it's good now. But yeah, you ate half of it. The fuck, mom?
Wait, did you want to amend your dish, Ryan? It looked like you wanted to.
No, I'm sticking by my dish, dude. This shit sounded delicious.
So steak, bell pepper, french fries, I'll get rid of the tomato
steak. I'll get rid of the steak. Lap chung is good enough as a meat.
I'm pretty simple. I think spam for sure would be my main ingredient. I think I've had crispy bacon bits in my fried rice. Not too bad, I gotta say.
Who the fuck made it with crispy bacon
bites? I'm telling you, it's...
Was it your mom?
No, I forgot where I had it. But it was like a surprise. I was like, oh, I didn't know I liked bacon in my fried rice. I also do like the mini shrimp. Not the fat shrimps, like the prawns, but like the smaller shrimp. I guess where I'm going,
that was good too.
As long as my fried rice has some crunch in it, the rice obviously has to not be
crispy. The rice that comes from like on the side of the bowl?
It depends. Like the crispy shit. I don't like my rice too crispy, but the other ingredients in it has got to be solid. Carrots. I'm iffy on peas. I think I'm okay with peas, but for sure, egg.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah, I got to have the egg. Let's talk about the band name. Marcus's band name, Hello Peril. What was interesting about that band name? What did it kind of come to mind, Brian?
It's a play on Yellow Peril.
Mm-hmm.
Some also say that it's a play on Hello Kitty, which is a big, big, big Asian pop culture reference.
Mm.
But it makes fun of kind of the stigma that Asians had.
Right.
Oh my God. And you think about like the lyrics that they have too, about like the whole entire band is a fucking meme, dude. It is great. But
the rap lyrics are written by Randall Park. He originally wrote it.
Oh, really?
Specifically
for this film?
Yeah.
Is he a musician?
I mean, I don't think he calls himself a musician, but he seems to have some musical talents.
Yeah, you can tell when someone knows how to rap. Like he can rap. It's
not a bad dancer
legit,
too
yeah.
in the movie.
Legit.
So it was all him. It was all him rapping and everything in the movie. It wasn't like voiceover.
No, that was him.
That's legit. So about Hello Peril. Like there is some historical significance between Yellow Peril.
Right. So Yellow Peril comes from way back in the day, probably around the Gold Rush. The origins of it is not too specific. It's not like one thing, but from U.S. history, kind of stems from where there was a mass migration of Chinese unskilled laborers, specifically during the Transcontinental Railroad era. And because there's this mass migration of Chinese workers coming to the U.S., they were also setting up shops all across, specifically, mostly in San Francisco, which is why they have a big Chinese population. You know, during this time, you know, the white people at the time saw this, you know, huge change of faces in their society. And so they started to see these Chinese laborers come over. And at the time, I think the press called it Yellow Peril, as if like the Chinese people were coming over to take over America. So there was this huge, you know, repulsion of Chinese workers. So much so. And this is kind of how racist America was back then, is that the government kind of agreed. And it kind of, you know, a sequence of events led to, I think, the only legislation in U.S. history that specifically targeted a group of ethnic people, which is the Chinese people, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, I believe. And that just basically barred immigration from Chinese workers. I think we're still eerily dealing with that today. You just substitute maybe not Chinese person, but you substitute another, you know, group of people.
And then also portrayed Chinese people immigrating as this evil folk coming in to take over the country. And it was also pretty prevalent in the Gold Rush too, where Chinese people, they had a tendency who came or immigrated to the United States to partake in the Gold Rush. They were always given the worst grounds or areas to excavate gold, which had already been taken by the white Americans. Mm-hmm. And hey, man, Chinese people found gold and white people got really upset about that.
Oh, they hated it.
They hated it because despite the fact that Asians were given the worst looting area because it's already been looted of gold already, Chinese people were still finding success.
The saying, not a Chinaman's chance, comes from that era because they would basically lower Chinese people down to the mines or parts that were, you know, not the safest.
Correct.
With a bunch of dynamite and accidents would happen. So a bunch of Chinese people died during that time. There's a famous photo of when the transcontinental railroads meet from the east and the west. I think somewhere in Utah or something like that, where the last spike is driven, where the railroads connect. And if you look at the photo, it's a whole bunch of white people and not one Asian person in the photo, even though Asians probably did 90% of the work. Let's talk about Sasha's parents. The interesting dynamic in there, because Brian, you brought up the fact that Sasha's parents, as you can clearly see, actually in like the first scene of the movie, that they're not around. Actually, we don't even meet Sasha's parents until she's a full grown adult. We don't even see what they look like when she's a kid. The relationship is basically summarizes where her parents were not around. What's your opinion in terms of why that was important to kind of include that into the story?
One, it's accurate. I think just Asians or immigrants coming over here, you have to do whatever it takes to put food on the table. Part of whatever it takes is having to work insane amount of hours at whatever you do, which I guess we can all agree traditionally is restaurants. And that's actually what they didn't work at a restaurant, did they?
I think they said they had a shop.
They had a shop.
Yeah, whatever that means.
But they worked a fuckload of hours. And mm-hmm. so they weren't there, especially in the first scene where they didn't even show up at that, you know, at dinner time to cook for Sasha. And as Sasha grew older, I mean, she grew a sort of disdain towards her parents, right? Because she saw how Marcus's parents were there for him the entire time. But hers was, you know, her parents were noticeably absent. It was something that I think we can all relate to, where our parents just work so many hours so that we can have an easier life growing up. And for her, I mean, she's a product of that, right? Part is because she has, you know, a personality of Alan, where she's a go-getter, you know, achieved her dreams. But at the same time, her parents weren't there. And so when they finally got older and they're at, you know, their retirement age, they kind of kick back a little bit. But at the same time, that is too late for her. I think they eventually made amends by the end of the film.
I mean, I think she just had a very estranged relationship with her parents. The fact that her parents weren't the most nurturing kind of created the pathway to Sasha's, you know, goal, focus, ambitious lifestyle, because she's always been on her own.
Independent.
Yeah, her independent personality. There's a moment in the movie where she's talking about with or accepts the fact that she's no longer with Brandon. And she's like, I might have a kid on my own. I had no parents anyways, so I'm used to being alone. That also kind of, I think, builds that wall that Sasha has as a character, not being so receptive, even to Marcus at first. You know, he tries to understand her, but she's, again, she doesn't make the most logical decisions in the people that she tries to get close with. You can see with the guys that she dates. I think that kind of stems from that, from her not getting that nurturing, loving relationship from her parents.
I think you bring up a really good point, Ray, but I think if we can continue to pull up layers around this, I mean, she wants that, right? She wants some sort of attachment, some sort of love that anybody can provide her, especially Marcus. I think there was a scene in the movie where Marcus and Sasha got into an argument. They were in their her rented San Francisco home. They were kicking it, doing really, you know, extremely fine. And then they got into an argument where then she got into the car and said, you know, don't come to the event with me tonight, right?
It was when she wanted him to go to New York. And he didn't want to, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They had an argument because Marcus was like, you're still not going to New York, are you? She said, hell yeah, I am. This is my life. And then they had an argument. And then right before she gets into the car, she's like, whether or not you come, like if, because in the house, that's when she's like, don't come to the event. And then she gets outside right before the car. And she's like, I love you, Marcus. And I'm going to New York, and you can choose, like, if you can come with me or not. And ultimately, it shows that this is Randall's final almost final moment where he's like, I'm not.
He chickens out.
He falls back to what he's comfortable with.
Yeah.
She also falls back into what she's comfortable with, independence, right?
Is that wrong, though? I would say that part of it is kind of she's trying to say, like, this is my career, just because I'm here in San Francisco, that I shouldn't sacrifice that lifestyle. I think that's where the conflict of the movie, the battle between lifestyles, like who's going to budge first? Because one side of it, Marcus believes that she's got to stay home, right? This is San Francisco. Why would you want to leave? But I think Sasha's trying to explain to Marcus, is like, that is what I do, but that's not who I am, kind of thing. And sometimes I think Marcus just doesn't see that.
Yeah, I would say that she did take off her cloak of vulnerability and showed that she wants Marcus, right? I mean, to your point, Alan, you were saying, like, you can come with me. Mm-hmm. But then getting into the car, she cried.
Yeah.
She was really, really hoping that Marcus would, you know, make these decisions for him in his life and then turn over a new leaf. But unfortunately, at that moment, it didn't happen.
And he, I think part of it, he says, I'm just a regular guy. I think that he just took that personally. I mean, why do you think, if Marcus is a real person, why do you think it's so hard sometimes for guys to kind of accept that role when the woman tends is very possibly more successful than the guy?
Yeah, and this goes back to the patriarch society that we all live in, where a man will feel threatened if the person, woman that he's with, more successful than him. And when she said to Marcus, I said you're a regular guy as a compliment to you. He's like, the fuck's that supposed to mean? I'm below you? But the reality is that a lot of men, they put women below them. Mm-hmm. And women, they've been fucking warriors about this and accepting it. But when a woman is more successful than a man, all of a sudden, he's in a bad position. That's what I really liked about this. That's what I really liked about this movie, in that it kind of flipped it around and it showed that a woman can be successful and that a man is the one who can grow up.
Let's go to our final segment. So we're going to call this segment the most swipeable moment. It's a date movie. And if we're going to see this moment on our dating app, I'm going to ask you guys if you guys would swipe right or swipe left.
Let's do this.
So the moment is when Sasha has moved in, or already in New York, and Marcus is trying to win her back by calling her and stuff like that. And he tells her, like, oh, you know, the band's getting real big because someone's buying up all of our merch. Finds out that Sasha is that person who's buying all that merch. Like, what's your take on that moment? Like, do you think that's cheap or cheesy, too cheesy even for a rom-com?
It's not too cheesy for a rom-com because it's exactly what a rom-com basically crescendos into. It raises some good questions, because Marcus goes to her and he's like, yo, like, I'm really successful now. Like, my merch is selling off the hook. But it turns out she's the one who purchased it all. And she did so that he could kind of rid his old inventory and so that he can start his new life with her. Is that the right thing to do? Couldn't, like, fake his success?
Would you swipe right on that?
Assuming that Marcus, his conviction is wanting to be with Sasha, then yes, I would swipe right on that, because ultimately she did something out of her own pockets so that he could be with her.
I would also swipe right. I like happy endings, man. I think if I were to swipe left, it was like, shit, dude, I just ruined the relationship again. You know, I can't. Yeah. I got to go another, 16 years without seeing you? But I will say this, though. He found out, but he used the money that she gave him by buying all his merch to buy a fucking suit to go to her event in New York. So he got her back. This is all well that ends well.
So this is why I would swipe left on that, okay? First of all, how did he not put two and two together that all of this merch came under the name of D'Angelo going into one spot? And if you think about it, all that merch is just back into his inventory. What are they going to do with all that merchandise?
Well, the name of the tennis ball song, you want four hair, take five.
Now, if I'm thinking, I'm just thinking too logically. He's just like, man, what am I going to do with all this stuff that I thought? He just basically got free money because now he has to resell it. Well, that's going to conclude our episode. And I first want to thank you guys for joining me again on this cinematic adventure. Tune in next time. Alan, Brian.
Thanks for having us, Raymond.